So tonight's Dhamma talk is won't be so much of a Dhamma talk in the strict sense, and more of a travelogue. Maybe there might be some Dhamma in there somewhere, who knows? But it's a bit difficult. It's quite a formal environment here in the cave. But if anyone, please, if anyone has any questions or anything, maybe be a bit more relaxed than we are normally in the talk. So please feel free to comment or ask questions or anything, if there's anything that strikes your interest. What I'll do is I'll just try to tell the story as it happened, because the trip got better as it went along, and so I get to kind of build up the story a little bit. And as you all know, the main purpose of the trip was to go to Bodh Gaya for this chanting ceremony organized by the Light of Buddha Dhamma Foundation, which is associated with Tathang Tulku Rinpoche. And I knew very little about this before going, and except that it was a Tibetan group who was organizing a chanting ceremony for Theravadan Sangha. And so, as is my habit, I tend to plunge into these things rather than wasting a lot of time with sort of preliminary investigations and things. I just go and then see what happens, bearing in mind the Buddha said, whatever you think it's going to be, it'll turn out different. So I didn't worry too much about what I thought it was going to be like. Anyway, so on the way, stopped off in Bangkok and met my teacher, Ajahn Mahachachai, who I hadn't seen for, I guess, about 4 years. And very delightful to meet him again, and such a lovely monk, very, very warm and sweet, and you know, consistently when talking with him, I mean, my experience, I don't have very much experience, but of all the Thai Ajahns that I've met, he teaches the best Dhamma, you know. I don't know whether he's the most, you know, highly realized or anything like that, but certainly his Dhamma is fantastic. And what was he talking about this time? He was talking a lot about emptiness this time. I was trying to remember exactly what he said. He was talking about emptiness and seeing things as empty, and he said, like, there's this kind of great emptiness where you see that there's nothing there, and like even the mind you see is empty and there's nothing there in the mind. Even the knowing is not there. And so, of course, being of philosophical and disputatious bent, I pressed him and said, well, how do you know that if there's mind isn't there, then how do you know? And he said, this is what they call the original mind or something like that. It's like when the mind is not there. And I said, well, how do you know that if there's no mind, how do you know it? And he just said, this isn't a theory. It's not some kind of theory that you can learn and explain. It's an experience. So he's very, very lovely monk, and he was very happy to hear of the work that we're doing here at Santi. And we're doing very positive work for Dhamma. And it's interesting, you know, he teaches, as I said, I mean, I haven't heard anyone but teach Dhamma better in Thailand, including any of the great masters of the forest tradition, and yet he just stays very quietly in this little monastery in Bangkok, and not that many people go there, and not, you know, the numbers haven't really grown in the time I've been seeing. I've known him for 13 years or so, 14 years, and the numbers of people going there hasn't really changed. But he seems to just be very content. He's not into self-promotion or doing lots of kind of big things and so on, but he stays there and does his meditation and teaches people who come to him. So after that I went to just one night there, and then went up to Wat Nanachat for a few days. And it was quite nice to see a few of my old friends. Of course, the vast majority of the monks there I didn't know at all. But I saw some surprising old friends. Ajahn Pasano, my first teacher at Wat Nanachat, was there, which was a great surprise. Of course, Ajahn Yana was there, and Ajahn Yatiko, who was a very good friend of mine when I was a young monk. And he was there. He's normally staying in Daodam, in the branch monastery in Daodam, but he was visiting. And it was very nice to catch up with him. He actually left the same day I arrived, and so I went with him out to the airport and spoke to him. Hopefully, there's some chance he might be coming to Australia, so hopefully we might see him out here. And he asked me, he said, "Oh, well, if I come and stay in your monastery, what am I going to do, because I'm more senior than you? What are we going to do?" I said, "Well, we could try being nice to each other." I said, "All right, that sounds all right then." It's kind of bizarre how these things get in the way of things. It's kind of weird, you know. And actually, you know, you could see it was quite a serious. I mean, I have to admit, I was quite distressed to see how these things are handled at Nanachat. I mean, this is how I've always felt for many years. And I know a lot of other monks feel the same. It's just this kind of almost obsession with seniority and stuff, which is goes way beyond anything which is remotely vinaya. In fact, it's even pursued to the point where it's against, you know, directly against the vinaya, like having that one toilet specially for senior monks and another for junior monks. You know, I mean, this is completely against the vinaya. The vinaya says you do not allow going to the toilet in order of seniority, you know, and so it's quite an explicit and clear rule there. I was quite disturbed to see this. It seemed to be not set up a healthy dynamic in the community. And so I have to admit my time at Nanachat was highly ambiguous, like seeing, you know, some of my old friends, and that was very good. Another old friend I met was this novice Asoka, who actually, when I was a Pakao and an Agarika, he was like just a novice, just ordained. Actually, when I first arrived, we were Pakaos together and Agarikas together, and then he disrobed as a novice, and now he's come back again 10 years later and ordained. He's a monk now, so that was nice to see him. And so people have these weird trajectories in their lives. And so sort of showed up at Nanachat, and yeah, there's so many things I found, you know, like it kind of graduated spittoon sizes. I mean, I look at these things, I think, this is kind of bizarre, you know? And I mentioned it to some, I was talking to some people afterwards, you know, they were saying, you know, what kinds of things, you know, when you're talking about the seniority, what kinds of things? And I said, well, you know, if you're a junior monk, you've got a small spittoon, and then if you're a middle monk, you've got a medium-sized spittoon, and then if you're a big monk, then you've got a big spittoon. And they're like, "You're kidding," you know. I said, no, really, they really do this, you know. And it's just so bizarre, you know. I mean, I'm still, maybe the problem is that I still only get a medium-sized spittoon, maybe that's it. I'm felt upset that I didn't get a big spittoon yet. Wait a few more years, I'll be there. And it just sets up this kind of dynamic. I mean, described very aptly by the monk I met, Pia Dhammo, who I'd never met before, but he's a bit of a legend in our Sangha. He's a kind of unreformed anarchist from the German Berlin punk scene. And there's actually a whole group of monks who were kind of in the punk scene in Berlin. Jatamalo and Pia Dhammo and Analio. And Pia Dhammo was saying that he'd been speaking with Analio about, and they'd actually been at the same punk gig in Berlin where there was this big brawl, and Pia Dhammo had been injured in the brawl, and Analio had been one of the bouncers who had been doing the injuring. And so he wondered whether he had this scar that he was carrying around from strange karmic connections, or maybe they'd been in some kind of intense Abhidhamma dispute in their past life or something like that. And Pia Dhammo is kind of known for his very ascetic, very hardcore. And when he's a young monk, he used to sort of research in the Jain Sutras to find ascetic practices to do, like, you know, drinking water only one time a day, or filling his backpack up with rocks to carry up the hill, or running 3 times around the monastery before the morning meeting started at 3:30 in the morning, and all of these, or just eating one lump of rice a day during the rains retreat, and then having to go to hospital at the end of the rains retreat. These kinds of things he used to do, and so very intelligent, and you know, quite. I mean, he's obviously a character, but he's, you know, quite perceptive, and you know, one of the things he said about the seniority, he said, you know, seniority, it's good for, you know, maybe deciding who goes first at lunchtime, you know, that's about all it's useful for, but if you, you know, you insist on it, you end up with all these spineless sycophants which I thought was an interesting observation. Some of you may not know what a sycophant is, but in Australia you usually call them suckholes. It's the usual idiom when I was at school. And this is really kind of what I noticed, you know, that day with the junior monks and stuff, is that there was this really, I felt like a real kind of lack of spirit, like people just so tense and afraid to kind of do anything. I didn't feel like I was being kind of treated like a normal person, you know, being treated like I'm someone special or something. I found this very unusual. Not everybody is like that. I met Dhammadipa from Adelaide, as some of you know, Mahesi knows, and a few of us know. He was really good. He was doing really well, but you know, he also didn't feel very satisfied staying there. So I got a lot of ambiguous messages, but that's how it's always been at Wat Manachat. It's always been like that, and I guess it always will be. There are obviously a lot of good things going on there, but it seems to somehow not be able to escape from its nature in some way. When it was started, there was a lot of military people who were there, and it seems to have kind of kept this kind of pattern, being almost like a boot camp or something like that. And really, you go there and you learn Khor Wat is basically what it's about. Khor Wat being like, you know, how to clean your monastery and how to kind of day to day etiquette and so on of being a monk. And that's really what you learn there, and not very much else. You know, I guess you learn about the forest tradition a bit. But, you know, they certainly don't get any regular teachings in the suttas or anything like that. So, you know, Dhammadipa was, he certainly felt that he would be getting a better education, a better training in Australia. So Ajahnyana was not sure how long he was going to be staying on in Manachat. I said to him that some people said that you might not be wanting to stay on indefinitely or something like that, and he said something along the lines of, "Oh, that's the understatement of the year." So he basically wants to get out as soon as he can, but there's no one to replace him yet. So he's certainly done a good job in terms of managing the monastery and the physical place and the whole administration and structure of it. He's done a very good job, and that's not a small thing. It's a tremendous sacrifice to be able to give so much of your time and energy to those kinds of things. None of us become monks because we want to do those things, and a lot of us sort of resent it and try to avoid it. So I certainly appreciate that you know, tremendous amount of work that he's done in that respect, because it was very problematic. They still had their fair share of problems. Ajahnyana had, many of you heard about the problems with corruption and things later on. Well, even though they've kind of kicked the corrupt ones out of the monastery, but unfortunately it seems that they're still not satisfied. They had actual repeated intruders coming into the monastery during the rains retreat. Of course, Ajahnyana uttered the magic words during the rains retreat, "Oh, things are going so peacefully and so well, there's been no problems so far this rains retreat." Immediately calling into existence this wave of intruders breaking in through the women's section and coming in and coming out again, and they didn't know what they were for. Eventually, this rumor was going around the villages that Ajahnyana had, I think, 2 million baht or something, that's like $100,000 or something in cash stashed in his kuti for buying land or something like this. And the army heard about it. He eventually had an army platoon camped outside his kuti and for half the rains retreat. And the kind of the bizarre thing was that the frightening thing was that the intruders kept on coming even after they knew that there was an army platoon there with machine guns and stuff. And that didn't deter them. And there was nothing really that anyone could do to stop them. They thought that it was something to do with the ex-committee members whose son or something like that was involved with a drug gang and had debts which needed repaying and blah, blah, blah. And that it was something to do with that. This is what they thought. But no one really knew how to stop it. The police didn't really know. The army didn't know. What are you going to do? You know, you've got the army there and they're still coming in. There's only one force in Thailand, which is stronger than the army. And some of the soldiers who overheard the conversation about who they thought was doing it later went to the kitchen and discussed it with the old women from the village. And when the old women from the village heard about it, the intrusion stopped. And this was the power that was the only thing that was able to stop the whole problem. So this was my kind of experience in Thailand. Of course, I did like a Q&A last night that I was there. I did a Q&A session with some of the monks and novices and that, and of course it didn't take them very long before they started asking me about bhikkhunis, and so we talked about that, and you know, that kept on going quite a long time into the night, till you know, at 10 o'clock or something at night. And you know, it was a bit disappointing to hear how little that, you know, they knew in terms of even like very, very basic knowledge about these things that we take for granted, and no kind of environment or encouragement to actually even think about it. I mean, not even, you know, so much as taking a position or trying to do anything about it, but even to actually have an acquaintance with the basic facts and be able to reflect on it intelligently. I mean, this was, you know, it's simply like a taboo subject. No one ever talked about it. But of course, many of them, you know, many of them just young guys. There weren't any women staying there at the time. Not any Western women anyway. And, you know, these were kind of young guys who, you know, of course, were very sympathetic to the whole thing, you know, and kind of puzzled by the problems and things like that. But, you know, I think it's still very disappointing that there's so little, you know, positive encouragement. I think it needs to be something that's articulated and spoken about. Anyway, I haven't been lax in that regard over the last few weeks. So then, off to Bodh Gaya. Flew into Gaya, shiny new airport. Amazing. Amazing, they've got this incredibly, you know, kind of marble and really kind of flash new airport there in Gaya, in the middle of nowhere. And of course, but just so you feel at home, they've still got the traditional Indian bureaucracy. So... So it's like, I mean, this was on the way home, not on the way in, but you know, it's desk after desk with stamp after stamp until your ticket's covered with so many stamps and scribbles and things like that you can't tell one from the other. The classic one was when we went to one check thing and they said, no, you've got to go over there. That man, and there was a series of desks and there wasn't anyone at them, but there was one man standing next to one of them and you have to go over there. So we went over there. And said, oh, the fellow told us to come over and see you. And the fellow said, oh, yes, okay. And just sort of looked at our things, oh, yes, okay. And then just walked off and didn't come back again. So we just stood there for like half an hour or 45 minutes or something like that. And then this other fellow kind of came along and looked at our things and said, oh, you're very late. You should have come much earlier than this. So we had to restrain ourselves a little bit. So, but it was very nice coming into Gaya. Of course, the plane was, of course, full of all pilgrims and monks and things like that. I got on it was an Air India plane. I never travelled on Air India before. It was very funny. It was all these kind of, you know, these kind of old Indian matrons. The air hostesses were these kind of middle-aged Indian matrons who were kind of bustling around and dishing out chai and stuff. And when I got on the plane, there was one monk sitting in business class. And then I had this unwholesome thought of criticism. Oh, that's terrible, monks shouldn't be riding in business class. And then the hostess looked at my ticket and said, oh, where are you sitting? And then she said, oh, there you're sitting there. And and they put me in business class as well. Oh, well, that'll teach me. So then we got to Gaya, and the welcoming committee came, and they had Wang Mo and the people, and they had... These beautiful Tibetan silken scarves that they gave us. It was very beautiful. And so the main organizers was... The main organizer was actually Thakhan Tulku's daughter, or one of his daughters. I think at least three. I met three daughters. And this one, Wang Mo. Very lovely woman, very... very devoted and so on. Apparently her father's told her to work for 25 years to re-establish the Theravadan Sangha in India. This is apparently he does this kind of thing. So he's quite forward in his demands and expects a lot from people. So So I learnt a little bit about what he does and so on, and I didn't really know anything about him before, but he has this place called Odeon in Northern California. And apparently Odeon is like Shangri-La, so everyone else in the world thought that Tibet was like Shangri-La, but the Tibetans thought that Odeon was Shangri-La. And this is what they call it, it's got 1,200 acres. And on that they've sort of recreated all these parks and monasteries, so they've rebuilt all these monasteries that were destroyed by the Chinese. And they've recreated all these artworks and things like that. They have their own foundry, they have their own printing press. They've printed 2.5 million books for free distribution. And they've done all this stuff, and it's completely closed off to the public. So they just have the community who works there. He doesn't want people to be distracted by visitors and things. So people just go there and work very hard, making all these things and just recreating the whole kind of lost world of Tibetan culture in this park. And this is the work that he's doing until he dies, I guess. He's sort of in more or less semi-retreat permanently. And that's just like one arm of his kind of empire, and there's many other different things that they do. And they had set up this Mon Lam recitation for Tibetan and Nyingma tradition in Bodh Gaya, and that was been running into January since I think 1984 or something like that. And now it's up to about 9,000 monks, 9,000 monks and nuns. So quite a extraordinary event. But you know, he just said to them, you know, Dalang Tulku said, well, we've accomplished our aim of providing this service for the Tibetan Sangha. Now we should do something for the Theravadan Sangha in India. And so at the same time, Bhante Sivali, who's the head of the bhikkhu in charge of the Mahabodhi Society, also wanted to do something for the Indian monks, and he wanted to do a chanting ceremony, but he didn't have a sponsor. And the Lata Buddha Dhamma Foundation wanted to sponsor an event for the Theravadan Sangha, but they didn't have anyone to actually organize and do it. And so then they stumbled across each other, and so that really made it happen. But before that, Bhante Sivali had been talking to the other people in India and hadn't really got any response. No one was really that interested. No one thought it was possible. But then when they got this sponsorship, so then it all became possible. So they did the first one last year. His Holiness opened the event on the Kala Chakra cricket ground. It's used for Kala Chakra initiations when His Holiness is there, and for cricket at other times. And so this year His Holiness didn't come, which is probably a good thing, because they said last year it just became a bit of a, there's too many people and everyone just trying to get near His Holiness, and this became a bit of a nuisance actually. So then we went there, stayed at Daijokyo Japanese Temple, which was quite nice, very quiet. And the owner is this lovely guy called Kiran Lama, very, very sweet, and or the manager of it. And staying there is Wang Mo and her husband Richard, Wang Mo's, Tathagata Tulku's daughter, her husband Richard, their two children, another Richard, the second Richard, who was a friend of Bhante Sivali's and helping to organize it, and then this whole group of Brazilians. So there's this whole kind of troop of Brazilian women who'd come to organize, to volunteer. So they were the volunteers, and various other people who were there to do like photography and filming and all these kinds of things. And so it was quite nice for me to stay out there, because I got to meet the people who were organizing it. And what I found quite amazing was how sincere they were, you know. And because I didn't know anything about them, and I thought, well, what is this? You know, is it going to be political, or is it going to be all about prestige and blah, 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 or are they going to be real? And very quickly found out how very, very sincere they are. And one thing that really struck me when we were sitting around the table, and somebody said something about the Tibetan festival, and then somebody else says, yes, but now's the time for to talk about the Theravadins. I thought that was a very amazing kind of level of kind of awareness and use of right speech, you know. And, you know, just trying to make sure that they were just giving so much. I found this just amazing. Sense of giving and selflessness that they had. And as time went on, I began to learn more about their kind of the scope and the plan that they had for Bodh Gaya and for the Buddhism in India and things like that. And so it became very interesting the more I sort of learned about it. So there we were in the Daijokyo, and getting set up under the Bodhi tree to do the do the chanting. As well as the chanting, there was a series of talks. So the Dhamma talks, the three main Dhamma speakers, Ajahn Tong, Venerable Dhammasami, and myself. And Ajahn Tong was the teacher at Wat Chom Tong and Wat Rampung in Chiang Mai. And many of the Western monks started out there, Ajahn Sucitto, Ajahn Natthiko, Dhammarato, and myself all started out at Wat Rampung. Mechi Kema, who was here a few weeks ago, just come from there. And they've been teaching meditation in English for 30 years or something like that. And so setting up this service for doing retreats, they must have done thousands of very intensive Mahasi or Vipassana retreats. So as you know, I have certain difficulties with the whole Vipassana tradition. But, you know, no doubt that you know, Ajahn Tong has done this amazing service in just providing this. Nobody, you know, and, you know, you've got to put it into perspective. Nobody else in Thailand has done this. The only other Thai monk is Ajahn Buddhadasa, who provided retreats in Suan Mok for the Westerners, or for, you know, people in English. But nobody else, no other Thai monks in Thailand, you know, have done this. And so he's obviously got some very remarkable qualities. But he's like 84 now. And, you know, got a retinue and that, people following him around and things. His talks weren't that great, I have to admit. You know, it was going through a translator and, you know, quite stilted and formal. And but, you know, he's just basically just focused on practice and, you know, the usual kinds of things, which, again, I find difficult with the Vipassana tradition, you know. I mean, just an example. One of his talks was about this sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, which talks about the Dhamma Vihari. And it says there's different kinds of monks. One kind of monk is one who thinks a lot, Bahu Vitaka, and the other one who recites a lot, and the other one who studies a lot, and so on. And none of these monks are said to be the Dhamma Vihari. And the one who's Dhamma Vihari is, of course, the meditator. And when Ajahn Tong was telling this story, I thought, oh, I wonder how he's going to actually cap this off. Because, and then he, at the end, when he said for the meditator, oh, the Dhamma Vihari is the one who does Satipatthana Vipassana, which, of course, his meditation technique. As it happened, Venerable Dhammasami gave a talk a few days later and used the same sutta and actually quoted the Pali. And the actual Pali says, Ajhatang Cheto Samatha, practices Samatha of the heart within. So the text says, practices Samatha, and the explanation of it says, practice Satipatthana Vipassana. And, of course, you know, if you know the suttas, you just get completely used to these kinds of things. And another one of his talks was all about, you know, be afraid of pleasure and rapture, and all of these things are bad for you, and they're big obstacles in your meditation, and so on. And I do find that, you know, with all due respect, and, you know, I do have tremendous respect for him as a monk and for what he's done, but I do find it a bit difficult to... It just makes it so much more difficult to actually teach the Dhamma when people have these wrong views around the place. And, you know, who am I? You know, Ajahn Tong, he's been a monk for 64 reigns, you know. Sangharaja of Bangladesh came and they had to ask each other, how long have you been ordained? You know, one had 59 punces, the other one had 62 punces or something like this. And so the one who had 59 punces had to bow to the other one. It's the first time that had happened in many years, probably. But he's been a monk for so long, so who am I to say, well, actually, you didn't actually get the Pali right. Anyway, so that's Ajahn Tong. And then this other monk, Dhammasami, was quite an interesting character, although I didn't get to really meet him or speak to him very much. But he's a Burmese monk, originally Burmese, and is now, he's been a monk for 30 years or something like that, and he's a part-time lecturer at Oxford Centre for Buddhist Studies. So he's kind of an interesting in that he's from that Burmese Satipatthana background, and yet, of course, exposed to all the kind of the modern scholarship and so on from his training at Oxford. So he gave some quite nice Dhamma talks, you know, quite simple, straightforward, you know, emphasizing a kind of a balance of practice and so on and scholarship. And I thought some of his answers were very nice. For example, somebody asked him, you know, basically, you know, isn't it just a waste of time to be just doing a lot of scholarship without practicing? And he gave a very nice answer, I think, which is he talked about the example of T.W. Rice Davies, who was the great founder of British Indology And, you know, he never really thought of himself as a Buddhist, although he said he was, you know, the Eightfold Path was a great inspiration for his life. And he never meditated or anything like that. But, you know, through his work and through the efforts that he's done, it's made the Dhamma available to so many millions of people through that work that he's done. So it's not something which should be denigrated or criticized. He's put in the causes for so many other people to practice. So, yeah, Dhammasamy gave, you know, some quite nice talks, but also from that kind of vipassana kind of background. So while these talks were going on, because I didn't have any idea when I started what I would talk about. Actually, the sponsors wanted people to talk about the suttas in the Digha Nikaya, which we're actually chanting, but the monks didn't do that. And so I thought, well, I'll talk about the gradual training, which is repeated 12 times in the Digha Nikaya, one third of all the suttas, as the gradual training on sila, samadhi, panya, ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And so I decided to do my three talks, one on sila, one on samadhi, one on panya. And to try to show, well, this is actually what we find in the Digha Nikaya. This is actually what the Buddha is pointing to again and again and again. So to talk about the chanting ceremony a little bit, I was talking to some other people before, if anyone's been to the Mahabodhi temple, and once there's a huge chetty, of course, very beautiful stupa, which they're just nearly finishing the renovations of. And they've done a lot of detailed work on all the niches and decorations and things like that. They've installed stone Buddha rupas in a lot of the alcoves and niches and things like that. So it's looking very beautiful. It's still not completely finished. Don't know if it'll ever be totally finished, but certainly looking very good. They've done a very good job on it. And the main group was the Indian, Bangladeshi and Sri Lankan sanghas, who were all sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. And when we first arrived, it had rained for a day or two, which was quite lucky for me because it meant that the area we were sitting was muddy, and that meant that they had to get platforms, and that meant that I could sit on the platform with my legs off so I didn't destroy my knees. So I was quite lucky for that, so I had to sit at the back of the platforms, which actually, as it turned out, was remarkably useful, which I'll come to later, but we were sitting there, the Thais were sitting quite close in another group. They were quite a 100 altogether, maybe 50 monks and 50 or so lay people, Mechis and lay people. And very loud, a loud PA and chanting. But they did quite a good job in that the Thai, whoever was doing the chanting, I'm not sure who it was, but some senior monk from Thailand, but he also gave explanations of all the suttas as they went along, which was very good. Cambodians had their little set up, I guess about 30 or 40 Cambodian monks, and the Burmese had their little one as well, I guess similar number, 30 or 40 Burmese monks, doing their uncopyable chanting style. And they had like 24 shrines at the front of their thing, 24 little shrines, one for the Hetu Paccaya, one for Aramana Paccaya, Adipati, all of the 24 conditions of the Abhidhamma. Bhatana were all there, one each had their own individual little shrine. So it was very sweet. And so the monks were kind of distinct in that way, and anyway, it was a bit of a shame that there wasn't more opportunity for mingling and so on. But I guess there's also like there's a degree where you can tolerate stuff, you know, a lot of these monks are all from overseas already, you know, and how much can you actually deal with or cope with in terms of, you know, cultural shift and things like that. A lot of these monks are probably quite not used to traveling, not used to being in a foreign place, so quite difficult for them. And so usually they would eat at different places, the different temples and things, and staying at the different temples. I usually ate at the, most of the time ate at the Mahabodhi Society. And initially I ate, they had like a big tent outside Mahabodhi Society where most of the Indian monks and stuff would eat. And initially I just ate there, but after kind of repeatedly, and there was the kind of the inside group where the kind of the senior monks, Sivali and Yanananda, were eating, and got invited to sit there, but I just sort of was kind of rebelling against the whole kind of privilege and seniority thing, so I preferred to just go and eat with the hoi polloi in the tent. And for a few days, but after a while, I kind of accepted the invitation to go and eat, and it was actually a very good thing because to my surprise, you know, the monks who were there actually very quite remarkable bhikkhus, and I'll talk a bit more about that later on. But to come back to the chanting ceremony, so we had this chanting, so sitting on these platforms, about 150 monks where we were, right under the Bodhi tree, a few little old Indian nuns coming along, pretty kind of sad and sorry lot, you know, a bit kind of bedraggled I mean, those of you who've been to India know that, like, the Indian Sangha in general doesn't get much support or much training, and so it's probably even more so of the nuns. They didn't really have a lot of really know what they were doing all that much, and it's a bit unfortunate that they were kind of made to sit with the lay people. So you had like the platforms, and then there's like a marble walkway in between platforms on either side, and then the marble walkway, and the nuns sat there with the lay people, except for one Vietnamese bhikkhuni who was very bright, very confident, and she just said to the Indian or Bangladeshi monks who were organizing, she said, "I'm a bhikkhuni, I should sit with the monks." And they were like, "Oh, okay. And so she just sat up with the monks. And actually, there was much less... I certainly felt much less problem around bhikkhunis and things like that with the Indian monks and Bangladeshi monks. They're much more relaxed about it than you certainly find with the Thais. They haven't been ideologized to the same degree. I mean, obviously people still have their ideas and their prejudices and things like that, but it's not so rigid. At least I didn't feel like it was nearly as rigid. And this is one of the great things about the Indian Sangha, is that they're not trapped in any particular cultural model. They don't have a model, they don't have an example, which is the problem for them at the moment. But it does mean that if they are set in the right direction, that there's a great potential there. So, but the good thing that did happen with the nuns is I was very pleased. Unfortunately, I don't know if anyone got a photo, but after a few days, they took the platforms away. When the earth dried out, the ground dried out, they took the platforms away, so that you ended up with like this marble walkway in the middle, raised platform on marble, with the nuns sitting on there, and then the monk sitting on the dirt on the lower ground next to it. And I thought that was a very wonderful moment to treasure in the history of Indian Buddhism, underneath the Bodhi tree. But didn't last for long, unfortunately. But this is one of the things, of course, that we talked about and asked that the nuns be given the proper place for next year, which will happen. And doing the chanting, very beautiful. Nyanananda's chanting was quite amazing. And he's got a beautiful voice and a beautiful feel to it, you know, and this kind of very, almost sort of slightly melancholic, but very calm and very peaceful, you know, and everyone said how beautiful it was, you know, even people, no matter what country they were from, everyone was saying, you know, how lovely it was just to listen to this kind of lilting, very simple chanting. Like sometimes the Sri Lankan chanting is kind of melodic, but it's a bit chaotic, like everyone's doing their own kind of melody thing. But he had a very simple, he'd really stripped it back and simplified it, and there was a lot of space, like long pauses between each of the words. I'll see if I can give a little bit of an example. The three refuges, it would be something like Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchami, Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchami, Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchami. This is something like the chanting style that we were using for the thing, and one of the results of it was that the Sri Lankans were chanting and the Indians were chanting much slower than everybody else. And of course, the ties that are going, evam me sutang ekam samayam bhagava varanasiyam viharati. And so they got finished a lot quicker than the thing, but I don't really know if that's quite the point, to see who can get it done the fastest. Yeah, but just very lovely. It wasn't very, you know, the whole thing wasn't very kind of rigid. There was no... What they did do is they made sure that, they had a register, so only registered monks, they had like a little badge, and only registered monks sort of took part in the official ceremony. And one of the reasons they were careful about that was because every monk who participated, monk and nun, got a copy of the text. So we all got a copy of the Digha Nikaya in Pali as a gift sponsored by the Taitung Talkers group. That was the VRI, Vipassana Research Institute, text, which they had formatted for them and printed up. So that was a very wonderful thing, so that everyone there got this copy. They've printed 1,000 sets. And even if later, if the numbers grow, they'll be giving like back issues to all of the monks who come later. So if by the end of the thing, if there's 1,000 or 2,000 monks, they'll end up with 1,000 or 2,000 sets of the entire Tripitaka if they come every year. So this is one of the things that they're doing, and it's one of the, like, the carrots they're doing to try to encourage the monks to come. And I'll give them all a set of the scriptures. So there we were, all kind of chanting away, and yeah, it was very kind of nice, very beautiful to sit under the Bodhi tree. The weather was really lovely, very inspiring to be there. And as I said, after a while I got to know Bhante Srivali and Bhante Nyanananda quite well. Nyanananda came there from Sri Lanka with a group of about 30 or so young monks, quite very kind of bright, intelligent young bhikkhus. All of them are about, only about 2 or 3 reigns. We talked about this a little bit before, but for those who aren't here, weren't there, Nyanananda, I mean, he seems to be almost kind of single-handedly starting this kind of reform of Sinhalese Buddhism. And he ordained originally in 1979, and then this road became a samanera, and then reordained, took full ordination with Ajahn Sumedho present about a few years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. And since that time, he's established about 30 branch monasteries, and there's about 300 monks under him in training, as well as other meditation centers or Vasika training centers. He's translated a large proportion of the suttas into colloquial Sinhalese. He obviously just has this tremendous barami, which, you know, I mean, he's a very lovely monk. He's very sweet. He's good natured. He's intelligent. He's very direct, and he's very sincere about his dhamma. You know, he's very straightforward. I don't want to get born again. But you know, you add up all these qualities, and then still, there's something else. You know, and these things happen to him quite kind of regularly. Like, you know, he'll tell stories where he was just, you know, walking up to Vulture's Peak, and then there's this little, you know, boy was walking up with him, and the boy said, you know, what are you doing? And he just said to him, you know, do you want to be reborn? And the boy just sort of, you know, or do you want liberation? And then the boy just kind of looked at him and just started crying. He said, I don't want to be reborn again. And then he just sort of bowed down at his feet and said, I want to take you as my guru. And so this is the effect that he has on people. And it's just something very special. And, you know, people here who know me very well know that I'm not the kind of guru type, you know. I don't kind of fall for these kinds of things very, very easily or very often. So, you know, it's quite unusual for me to meet a monk who I think really had those very special qualities. So he's been very committed to reforming the Sangha in Sri Lanka, and you know, developing good knowledge of Pali and the suttas and the Vinaya, and he's, you know, he's very much, you know, straight back to the suttas is really what he loves. It's just original Buddha's teachings, Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Path, don't get reborn, you know, this is where he's at. And he's done, you know, a lot of remarkable things in his life. He spent many years traveling through India, staying with the sadhus in Rishikesh and things like that. So, you know, he's been all through those things, trying to learn their meditation and things. And, you know, done many, many remarkable things. So he was there, and he had met What happened was that he had met Bhante Sivali from the Mahabodhi Society, and they had sort of been talking a lot about trying to help the Sangha in India. And then this ceremony came out of that. But Bhante Nyanananda wanted to do more. Now he's actually committed himself to go and live in India, and he's leaving behind his monasteries in Sri Lanka and going to live for at least 6 months of the year in India and start bhikkhu training centers there. So they're going to start Pali training colleges and bhikkhu training centers in India to try to bring together the Indian monks. And Bhante Sivali said something very nice about this. You know, he said the Indian monks, he said, they're very easy to criticize, but they have three very good qualities. One is that they have a lot of faith. Two is they have a lot of patient endurance. And the three is they have very good memories. And I thought, well, that's three qualities of Western monks, isn't it? You know, they've got a lot of doubts, little patient endurance, and dreadful memories. So, you know, that was really nice to hear him, you know, say those things actually reminded me a lot of the Isan monks, also similar kinds of qualities. And so they really want to take this on board because they know how Buddhism is growing in India and how it hasn't really got any direction. And so I learned when I was there, I kind of learned quite a bit more about what's happening in Buddhism in India. It seems you have really three main groups. One is the Ambedkarites, the Dalits or outcast people who kind of become converted to Buddhism. And that, of course, that movement is highly political. That's not to say that everyone who converts is purely for political reasons, but there's obviously a very strong political dimension to that whole movement. And that's, of course, you know, that's the untouchables. So that's like the kind of the lowest socioeconomic group in Indian society, with a very low education and so on. And then you've got the Tibetans, who really have been living in India like kind of oil and water, you know. They've just kind of been living there but haven't really influenced or affected the Indian culture at all. They've remained almost completely insulated from it. And I was very struck by this when we were talking with one Tibetan nun, a friend of Sister Jyoti Ma's, Tenzin Dolma, and she was staying in a monastery, big Tibetan monastery in the south of India, and the Holiness the Dalai Lama visited and asked the head lama of that monastery, have you been teaching the local people anything about Buddhism? And he said, no, we haven't. And he said, well, you must. You know, it's a very important part of your duty to teach the local people. Now, I assumed that when I heard that, I assumed that he meant the local Indian people, but I found out, no, actually he meant the local Tibetan people, the local Tibetan refugees. Even them, the monasteries weren't actually teaching the local Tibetans. Not even to think of trying to teach the Indians. And so this was, I think this is quite an important thing. And then the third group is middle class India, because of course middle class educated Indians are interested in Buddhism like middle class educated people are all around the world, but even more so because they're Indians. And so that movement has up until now largely been dominated by Goenka, and the Goenka Vipassana retreats and things is largely a kind of a middle class phenomenon. And so you've got these three quite distinct groups in India which haven't really had much to do with each other up until now. So then as I got to know these monks and I'm going to kind of talk to them, I kind of learnt, you know, more and more about how they're thinking and what they're trying to do. And they were really lovely. It's really lovely to see them together, you know, Sivali and Nyanananda. They're both very, very gentle, very, very compassionate monks, you know. And this was something I was, again, and it sounds really silly, but it's true. I'm not used to seeing, you know, monks or Theravadan monks of whom compassion is almost like the dominant or major characteristic, you know, the compassion and wisdom. And this is really where they're coming from. They just wanted to serve and to help. And it was very, very touching and very beautiful to see them together, like these two very close Dhamma brothers. And I asked Sivali one morning, we were sitting there at breakfast time and just making conversation, and I said to him, how is the Sangha in Sri Lanka? How's Buddhism going in Sri Lanka? He said, oh, not very good. He said, you know, these days a lot of them, there's not that many monks in Sri Lanka. He said, maybe 15,000 monks, which is very, very small for one of the major Buddhist countries. I mean, I think Thailand's more like 300,000. And he said, a lot of monks disrobing now, like a lot of them, in the past the monks were all ordained for life, but now a lot of them all disrobe, just go and get a degree at the university and then disrobe afterwards. They don't have like a real spiritual vocation. He said these days a lot of people go to the bhikkhunis for all of the services that they used to go to the monks for. So it's chanting and offering dana and things like that. They prefer to go to the bhikkhunis because they're practicing better. And so we talked a little bit about the kind of the bhikkhuni and things like that. And we talked about Burma, and I mentioned the case of Venerable Satyavadi, who was put in prison. And he was shocked. He'd never heard of anything. He never heard of this, and was like genuinely, like, how could anyone do this? Why do people think this? It's like this complete incomprehension of that. And it's very interesting to see that. You know, he had the same kind of reaction that you know, certainly most people that I've spoken to would have. But you know, he obviously, even though he's sort of brought up in a traditional Theravadan country, obviously he knew that the issue had been controversial and these kinds of things. But he still completely incomprehending as to why people could be so opposed to the very idea of having bhikkhunis. So time went on, and I started to meet a few people there, meet a few friends. One friend I met was Yom Jun, who I guess no one here probably knows, none of you from Thailand. But when I was a Pakao, an Anagarika in the jungle, you know Jun? In the jungles in Kanchanaburi, in Dadam, and I'd only been in the monastery, and then she was there, and we were cooking together. So the first time, since we were there cooking for the monks, and I've known June since all of those years, and spent a number of rains retreats together at Bhujang Kom and stuff, and then she happened to be in Bodh Gaya. So that was very lovely to see her. And I met also Venerable Dhammajoti, a monk from Wat Nanachat, again a very delightful Dutch monk. He's sort of his fifth rains, and he's doing Tudong around India. And we had many good conversations, and hopefully I'll try to encourage him to come to Australia. And I met this, and I mentioned before that the advantages of having dodgy knees, you see. And see, it's interesting, these things, because, you know, like the reason, why did I mess my knees up? Well, I messed my knees up by trying to force myself to kind of fit into the Thai form when I was staying at Nanachat as a young novice and a young monk, you know, and trying to force myself to do all the things that the Thais could do, and kind of just ended up wrecking my body doing it, you know, and realized, well, actually, you can't just force yourself to do these things, you know. And so that kind of forced me to kind of not conform in some ways, which has certain advantages. And one of the advantages, I ended up sitting at the back of the chanting next to the nuns. And so there's me sitting there chanting next to the bhikkhunis, and this Vietnamese bhikkhuni who was there was very, very lovely and very interesting. She's like 20 rains or something like that, and taught herself Pali and been in India for 14 years. She's actually, you'll get to meet her. She spends time in Melbourne as well, so she'll be coming by Sydney. She'll be coming by here sometime, probably in the next couple of months. I can't remember her name in Vietnamese. I called her, translated her name into Pali, Chandapadma. I called her by her Pali name, the Moon Lotus. And so we got to know each other quite well, and talking about various things about, you know, being bhikkhuni in India and the practice and meditation and things. And she's a very, very sincere nun. I was extremely impressed. And she's just graduated, just got a PhD in, transformation of the mind or something like that, did her PhD thesis. She was actually waiting to fly out to Australia. She was going to fly out, waiting till she could pick up her PhD, and she was flying out to Australia a few days later. So I got to know her, and then all these other remarkable nuns that I met there. Sister Tita Meda, who is this Russian nun from Amrawati, a very remarkable lady, ex-doctor, very, very gentle, very compassionate. Again, we had many cups of chai and long conversations. And met this Bhutanese bhikkhuni, the first bhikkhuni from Bhutan, Venerable Wangmo. And again, quite remarkable stories that she had to tell. She ordained in Silai Temple in California in 1988, I think. And telling me about the Sangha in Bhutan and what they were doing and so on. And these Indonesian bhikkhunis again, and they're again quite remarkable ladies, ordained in the same ordination ceremony as our own Sister Samachitta. You maybe even remember them. Did you notice any Indonesians there at the ceremony? You did? Yeah. So you probably recognize them. They'll be coming here as well. Yeah. So very strong, and but you know, very gentle. And I asked them, "Do you have any problems with the monks in Indonesia?" And then she said, "We don't have any problems with the monks, but sometimes the monks have problems with us." And one of the monks apparently said that if you give the dana to bhikkhunis, then you go to hell. It's a lovely and uplifting teaching. Anyway, so they invited me to breakfast. And so I went along for breakfast. They actually weren't there for the chanting ceremony. They were there to sit meditation all night. And they were going there for like 2 weeks and sitting meditation all night under the Bodhi tree every night. And they invited me to breakfast, and they were staying in this quite flash hotel, and we went there, and it was the only meal I ate in a flash hotel. And their supporters came up and they brought all this food onto the table, and I was very embarrassed because I realized that they intended all this food to be for me. And two bhikkhunis, one of them ate about one piece of toast and the other one ate about this much noodles and a couple of spoons of soup, and that was it. And then it was all this kind of pile of things. And no, that's for you. And I say, no, please, no, that's for you. So I tried to do my best to eat it, but I got sick, got food poisoning, and went and vomited it all up afterwards. So it'll teach me a lesson about eating in India. It's where you get sick is not at the dirty places on the side of the road, but in the flash hotels, eating the luxury Western food. So all these things going on, and I also got an email. I managed to check my email and got this email from this Western Meichi in Thailand, who just had all these awful experiences while staying in Thailand in the monasteries there. She didn't name the monastery outright, although I know where it was. And she was just horrified and appalled at what was going on. And then as this happened, I then met these other Meichis or ex-Meichis Westerners in Bodh Gaya. Two of them, one was still a Meichi, the other had spent some time as a Meichi, and also talking with them at some length, and you know, just spending quite a long, many hours listening to women's stories of suffering in Thai monastery. I came to have the opinion that there should be maybe like a new kind of psychological disorder, because ordaining as a Western Meichi in a Thai monastery is kind of like anorexia or something. It's like a form of self-harming. You know, it's just dreadful, the things that are happening. I mean, they're all psychologically abused and not infrequently physically abused as well. And, just exploited and all of these things, dreadful. And the stories they heard about the Thai monks in particular in Bodh Gaya were appalling. And their conduct ranges from merely uninspiring to utterly criminal and despicable. Not to say, of course, all the Thai monks are like that, but, you know, I mean, people were saying things along the lines of, oh, you know, half of the monks have got girlfriends and things like this. You know, this was the kind of the level of, you know, sila that they were alleged to have been keeping. And certainly my own kind of experiences didn't disabuse me of that kind of opinion. But, you know, these kind of nuns who'd had these dreadful experiences, and then, I mean, you know, could it be any worse? Well, yeah, I mean, there was a monk who had the same kind of experience, and he was also like, you know, I don't want to go into kind of all the details, but you know, basically, physically and psychologically abused staying in Thai monastery. And anyway, so I don't want to go into kind of all the sordid details, but they are certainly very sordid, and the things that I've heard, and quite... so much, you know, pain, and listen to this, and you see, you know, it's that situation where, especially for the women, are so radically disempowered and have no say or anything at all. And, you know, they seem to find it remarkable that there's a monk who's actually listening to what they're saying and actually saying, well, yeah, of course, it's what you're saying is true. You know, why didn't you see it earlier? Rather than just dismissing it or something. And many of them felt this way. They felt this way not just in the Thai monasteries, they also felt this way in the branch monasteries from our tradition as well, that they'd been to these places and places in the West, not just in Thailand, and also felt none of the monks were really interested or wanted to listen to their problems. And I think this is a very serious kind of issue. You know, it's not just happening once or twice, but it's quite endemic. So, you know, as kind of listening to these tales, on the one hand, hearing all of these kind of wonderful bhikkhunis and what they were doing and stuff, and then on the other hand, all of these poor women who were suffering so greatly, you see this kind of very contradictory status and so on for women in Buddhism. And time went on, and also had some interesting conversations. Well, and don't know how much I should go on. It's going on for quite a while, but anyway, had some interesting other conversations. Oh, I should mention actually something which is of interest. It's a little bit naughty, but anyway, when I met Piyadamo, he was telling me that because he'd spent 8 years in Paok Monastery in Myanmar, and because Piyadamo is a kind of radical anarchist and skeptic, wasn't about to kind of buy the whole thing, even though he'd been there for 8 years. He knows the place and knows the Sayadaw as well as anybody else. Interesting the things that he said, but one of the things that he said, which was quite interesting, he was talking to one of the monks there who apparently mastered all of the jhanas. So those who are not familiar with that system, then you have to have this thing where you can just kind of sit down and if you've really mastered the jhanas and the eight jhanas, you can sit down and determine to go into whichever one you want to for as long as you want. And so this monk had apparently completed the course and was able to do this. And so Piyadamo said, okay, well, we'll test it. He said, all right. Because one of the clear signs that it gives in the suttas is that from the fourth jhana, their breathing stops. And so he said, okay, we'll get a mirror, hold it up to your nose and then see whether you're still breathing when you're in fourth jhana. He said, okay, we're good to do it. And so they got the mirror. The guy sort of sat down and went into fourth jhana, and he said there wasn't really even any point. He could still see his belly moving up and down. He obviously wasn't even close to having even really tranquilized breathing, much less actually his breathing stopped. And then he sort of held the mirror up to his nose and knocked his nose, and he kind of jumped and so on. So he's obviously still kind of fully had his full body consciousness. So it seems that what he said was that there's this kind of almost like a double standard there, that in the Dhamma talks that the Sayadaw is very kind of gives a very strict standard for what jhanas have to be. And this is very kind of idea that it's this very kind of strict, but actually when they're talking to people in the interviews, they're much more, you know, telling people that they've got things which people even themselves are not really convinced of, that they have these attainments, and they have to be kind of convinced by their teachers that they have them. So that was interesting to hear that kind of perspective. And you know, I said, he was talking about one monk who had gone from the Goenka system to Paok system. I said, oh, well, he's kind of moving in the right direction. And Piyadamo said, well, oh, it's just moving from one sect to another or something. That was his position. So interesting to hear that kind of point of view. And had another point of view from this couple in... So apart from dealing with traumatized women, I also spent a reasonable amount of time dealing with vipassana victims. And this couple, lovely American couple, who also may be coming here. I've been doing a bit of... As soon as people hear the word caves and stuff, they go, cave? What do you mean cave? And this American couple who'd been at Bhayagiri and stuff, and they'd just been to stay with Pandita in Myanmar. And they said that they were there for 2 months. They said for the first month, the Dhamma talks were so bad that the only conceivable use that they could possibly imagine for them was to get over your attachment to hearing good Dhamma talks. that was their impression of their stay at the, supposed to be the premier meditation monastery in Myanmar. And they kind of got out before being too kind of badly scarred, but there, you know, a lot of other people who, you just see these things. One episode struck me quite, you know, these things, quite moving, you know. And there's one Thai Ubasika who was just kind of always there. I didn't really meet her or speak to her, but she was just one of the ones that's kind of saw her around. And you know, these the Thais, when they do the kind of the Ubasika thing, you know, they're very professional at it, you know. So she was one of these very, very kind of professional, but you know, all kind of dressed very, very kind of nicely in the white and black, and kind of everything's just right, and she's, you know, always kind of there on time and chanting. And And I met her a couple of times, and she's very kind of intelligent and spoke good English and stuff. And And then one evening after the Dhamma talk, talked to her in a little bit more detail, and you see someone who's, you know, seems to have it, you know, really together and to be, you know, really good, you know, student and practitioner and things. And she started saying, oh, she's, you know, follows Mahasi technique, which is a little bit unusual in Thailand, of course, not a kind of native Thai thing. And I thought, oh, okay. And she's also studied with Agul Pandita and a lot of the great masters and things. Oh, okay. She said she resigned her job about 4 years previously to go and meditate in Burma. But unfortunately it hadn't turned out like she'd wanted to. She'd gone there and had an accident and slipped her discs and stuff. She'd actually been paralyzed for a few minutes and very serious back pains and things, and had to really look after her body and so on, was telling me these things. And I said, oh, that's, you know, and I said, but at least you know, your mind is good, you know, even if your body's sick, you know, if you've been practicing a long time, your mind is still good. And she said, well, no, actually, my mind's all over the place as well, you know, and I can't sleep at night. I just got something, this is insomnia, and I just get these kind of headaches and things when I meditate, and these kind of tension building up around my neck and stuff. And I spoke to Upandita about it, and he just said, you know, keep on going, keep on meditating, and didn't have anything to kind of offer. And, you know, just to see this kind of thing again and again, you know, these poor people who go into these systems where they're being taught these very, very unbalanced practices, and people just don't seem to have any clue how to deal with it when it goes wrong, you know, just like so many others that I've seen. And so, you know, just trying to tell them to calm down, you know, to just be peaceful and push yourself so hard. You don't need to practice so intensely, and do some samatha practice. She said, is doing metta going to be good for me? And I said, yes, please, do some metta practice, and gave her the address of Ajahn Chah Chai in Bangkok. And so, you know, trying to do what I can to help. And, I found, you know, quite touching, these kinds of things, just trying to, you know, see the effects when you have these kinds of unbalanced practices. And, Venerable Nyanananda is very strong on this as well, you know, and you know, Sila Samadhi Panya, this is what the Buddha taught, and so he's very insistent on this, and quite forthright, much more forthright than I would be. And so this was kind of all going along. Then one night when we had this American group arrive in the Daijokyo temple. So now things are starting to get interesting, and this group was led by a fellow called Shantam Seth, who's a senior teacher in the lay teacher in the Thich Nhat Hanh's lineage. And he had this group of Americans who were all this kind of high-powered bunch that actually, I contacted them through Cecilia, who happens to be a member of UniBuds, and I knew from teaching the student groups in Sydney. She's now in London, so she was with this group, and there were all these people, like there was a, I can't remember who they all were, but one of them was Andrew Walensky, is the director of the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And then there was somebody else who was the head of some Buddhist cognitive therapy thing in the States. And then somebody else was like the head of, there's a group, lay group in Boston, who's trying to start a forest monastery in Boston. And so she was kind of the head of that group. And then, so all these people had all these kind of significant people within kind of American Buddhism. So we kind of sitting around talking and stuff, and found out, of course, we had quite a lot in common. One of them had done this translation of the Yoga Sutra and was studying the Yoga Sutra in relation to Buddhist stuff. And I said, oh, yeah, I wrote about that in my book on the history of mindfulness. And we started talking about this. And so they were really interested in the work I was doing and that. And I happened to have one copy with me, so I gave them a copy of that. Yeah, that was very, and they were all like, oh, when are you coming to the States? You know, have you ever been to the States? Oh, please come, and so on. So I said, please give me a break. But the really significant thing, they invited then Nyanananda and Sivali to come and speak with this fellow Shantam Seth. Now, he's an Indian, and again, from this kind of middle-class Indian Buddhist movement, and they were speaking about what they wanted to do to try to help Buddhism in India, and he was very supportive. And he'd said that Thich Nhat Hanh actually told him, you know, when he left his retreat or something like that, Thich Nhat Hanh said to him, you go and re-establish Buddhism in India. He didn't say, try to re-establish Buddhism in India. He said, re-establish Buddhism in India. And so he'd been trying his best to do this. And so they were talking, and that, you know, very supportive of the work that they were doing. And then Shantam said, "Oh, if you want to set up this bhikkhu training center, but have you thought of setting up a nuns training center?" And they said, "Oh yeah, we've already talked about that. We'd like to set up a nuns training center as well." And he said, "Well, actually, I have a little piece of land which I'd like to offer for that." And so that was kind of late one night, and next morning I went down and to the Mahabodhi temple and met this Vietnamese bhikkhuni and told her. I said, "Listen, let's set up this nuns training center in India." And she said, "Oh, she's already spoken with this Indian bhikkhuni. It needs to be an Indian bhikkhuni who runs it. She's spoken to this really good Indian bhikkhuni who'd ordained, she'd ordained with Phokong Shan under the Bodhi tree, I think in 1998. And, you know, been a teacher in the Goenka tradition and, you know, very experienced and knowledgeable in Buddhism. And they'd already spoken about setting up a bhikkhuni training center, but they didn't have a place and they didn't have support." I said, "Well, now you've got a place and you've got support, so let's arrange a meeting." So we run around trying to get people together, which of course is never the easiest thing to do in India. And unfortunately, the Indian bhikkhuni, Dhammadina, was away. She'd been staying, she was at Bodh Gaya, but she'd been away for that day and was not contactable. But we arranged a meeting anyway, and I had a meeting with Sister Chandapadma and Bhante Sivali and one or two others. We spoke all morning and tossed all these ideas, and then arranged a second meeting. After that meeting in the morning, I then spent the afternoon drawing building plans and getting estimates on building costs. In the evening, we met with Bhante Sivali, Bhante Nyanananda, Bhante Panya Deepa, who's the head of the, or secretary or something of the All India Bhikkhu Sangha. That's the main Theravadan Bhikkhu group in India. Two Indonesian bhikkhunis, Sister Chandapadma, and a couple of lay representatives. And Sister Titamaida. I said to Sister Titamaida, the Russian bhikkhuni from Amaravati, Russian nun from Amaravati, and I said, "Oh, why don't you come along? We're having a meeting today to talk about a nun center." So she said, "Okay." So she came along. I think she felt that she got plunged into slightly deeper water than she'd anticipated. So she's coming along for this meeting, and we're all having this meeting together. And and then we said, "Okay, let's start a bhikkhuni training center." And everyone said, "Okay, great idea." So they call the Buddha Vision. They have the trust. Nyanananda and Sivali have started a trust for their bhikkhu training centers, called Buddha Vision Trust. And so we do it under the auspices of that, and we set up the Buddha Vision Bhikkhuni Training Center. And we just kind of, everyone looked around at each other and said, "Well, let's just do it, okay?" And everyone said, "Okay, we'll be the management committee for the Bhikkhuni Training Center." So everyone was right. They said, "Okay, well, let's do it." So we did it. And then we sort of made this whole series of resolutions about what it should be. And so the basic idea was that we should start a place in Bodh Gaya, and doing it in Bodh Gaya partly because that's where Nyanananda and Sivali are located, but also because it gives us good access to support and to teachers, which would be difficult if it was in a more remote place. And it should be a place specifically for training bhikkhunis. And Nyanananda and Sivali both said, and I think quite skillfully, that we shouldn't kind of talk about kind of reviving the bhikkhuni order or anything like this. This is what would get people worked up. But you simply say we're training, so we're not sort of re-establishing or anything like that. But we're about training, and so it's not to be a guest house. No guests are allowed to stay there. Only bhikkhunis who've made a commitment, or lay women or whatever, to train, ordain and to practice there and study in both Hindi and English, with the idea of eventually being able to teach and to help the people of India specifically with their Dhamma. And done under a Buddha Vision, with the bhikkhunis basically running it. And the Buddha Light of Buddha Dhamma International of course expressed interest in helping to sponsor it. That wouldn't come under their specific charter. But there are other organizations within their umbrella group who would come within their charter. Part of the thing that that group wants to do is to redevelop Bodh Gaya. So they're actually, while we were having this meeting, Wang Mo and her husband Richard were in Patna meeting the permanent secretary to the chief minister and discussing development plans for Bodh Gaya and infrastructure development and things like this. So they're very serious about investing in the infrastructure in Bodh Gaya to improve it. So they're doing things like stopping all vehicles within like 1 kilometer of the Mahabodhi temple and things like this. So we had a very, very good meeting and very spirited, everyone giving their contributions. And as I said, Venerable Nyanananda, very direct. And he was speaking with Sister Chandapadma, and she said her background was in Goenka practice. He said, oh, well, you'll have to change that. He said, you know, the Buddha's taught Samatha and Vipassana and Sila Samadhi Panya, and, you know, not just Vipassana only. And he said, and Goenka, it's not really Vipassana anyway. It's not the real Vipassana the Buddha was talking about. So those kinds of things which I would kind of think, but I wouldn't actually kind of say it to somebody like that. And so, but he's just so compassionate and kind and stuff. It's not at all confrontation or anything. And she was like, oh, okay. And, but, you know, very clear that we want to have like an education which is grounded in the Pali Suttas and Vinaya. That would be the main focus of things. You know, a place for the nuns. We talked about various possibilities for pieces of land that might become available. And again, at the same time as we were doing this meeting, Wang Mo and Richard were talking, we found out later, to the government about possibly getting government grants for land for various uses in the Bodh Gaya area. And it seems that this is quite possible. And as the meeting wound up, then I said to, Venerable Nyanananda had to leave, and so I said to Bandi Sivali, we should take a photograph for this. So we sort of made, you know, a little bit of organization in terms of who was doing what and what resolutions we're passing and what we're going to do. And we all agreed that we had to look for a piece of land was the next thing. So I said, we'll take a photo. It was about 10 o'clock at night. And so we said, okay, we'll go into the main hall. Now, they just finished renovating this main hall. They spent a year. This is the original hall built by Anagarika Dhammapala in the 20s or something. And they just done this complete refurbishment prior to installing the relics of the Buddha and Sariputra Moggallana. So many of you may know these kind of relics, especially the Sariputra Moggallana relics were the ones recovered from the stupa at Sanchi, and the most famous relics in all of Buddhism. And these were recovered, and after they were found in the 1950s, they were taken all around the Buddhist world to Singapore and Hong Kong and everywhere, and they took them through the streets, paraded with these huge parades and hundreds of thousands of people coming out to see them. It was quite a major phenomenon in part of the revival of Buddhism. And these had just been installed the week before we started the ceremony. They'd been installed there by His Holiness the Dalai Lama, had personally installed them in this new vault built underneath the shrine in this temple. And so we went there, and then Bandi Sivali started to get them out. And so they've actually got there at the back of the shrine, they've got these kind of slabs which is built in this concealed thing with these concealed handles. And so they have to get two men to lift these slabs out. And then underneath the slab there's these kind of steel doors with padlocks on them. So we had to kind of open these things and then get through them into this vault and down the bottom. And then there's this safe in the thing, and you have to undo the safe. And then they actually got these relics out in these beautiful sort of gem-encrusted stupas, and then brought them out. And then we all held them and opened them and looked at them. These are the most precious relics in all of Buddhism. And we went around to the front of the shrine, and everyone's sitting there, and we took the photos with all the bhikkhunis holding these beautiful relics. So this was our photo for this opportunity for the starting the bhikkhuni training center. So that was very, very charged when that was happening. There was a lot of vibes happening in the air that evening. And so afterwards we went back, and then that was, for me, that was of course the highlight of the whole thing, to be able to be involved in something like that. And after I went back, we met this Indian Swami, who was quite interesting, Shantoshananda, and very kind of funny guy. He kind of looked a bit like Krishnamurti in his younger days or something like that, very kind of incredibly handsome and kind of glowing skin and kind of sleek black hair and kind of white kind of rose. It really looked the part of the kind of the modern Swami. He's kind of showing us photos of, yes, here's me with Bill Clinton and so on and so forth. And he's sort of pulling up his thing and showing us his weird contortions he can do with his stomach and stuff like that. And he said, do you levitate? He said, when I levitate, when I meditate, I usually float about that far above the ground like that. Would you like me to show you? And I said, no, I won't be necessary. And he was also very interested in the work that we're doing, and as it turns out, he's the personal yoga teacher of the new chief minister in the state, like the premier of the state of Bihar, and he teaches him yoga. So he, the next morning, gave the chief minister a ring and told him about what we were doing and got his support. So all of these things kind of happening, all kind of coming together in very wonderful and amazing ways. And then that last day we actually went to see a piece of land just before we came back. So this was crushed into like almost like 48 hours between Shantam's suggestion of a bhikkhuni place and then a nun's place and then all of this happening. And then on the last day, just before going out to the plane, we went out with Monday Sivali to this very lovely piece of land on the banks of the Naranjara River, exactly opposite the Mahabodhi Temple, and one of the few places in the region where, just near Sujata village, but there's a lovely little mango grove, and that's apparently government land which doesn't have any title claims on it at the moment. So we want to apply for that land for the Bhikkhuni Training Center. So this is what I've been getting up to for the last few weeks. And so very very deeply rewarding for me, and very enjoyable. And I certainly plan to go back every year as long as I can to contribute, and certainly if we can persevere and get this Bhikkhuni Training Center going, and I don't doubt that we will. Both the main parties, Bhante Sivali and Yanananda, you know, I mean, there's no doubt about their track record, especially Yanananda's track record. I mean, Bhante Sivali as well, being the head of, you know, he's still quite a young monk, he's only about 15 reigns or something, he's in his 30s. To be the head of the Mahabodhi Society, he's obviously very, you know, very organized, gets things done. And with the Lata Buddha Dhamma Foundation behind us also, then, I think there's no doubt that things will happen and that these things will be able to come true. So as you know, it's been my dream to help establish a bhikkhuni order in forest tradition in Australia, and I never dreamt that I would also be able to help in my own little way, be able to do it in India as well. So this has been a very, very happy and joyous occasion for myself. So I should probably stop there. I've been talking for quite some time. You've been very patient. This is Tathang Tulku's group. It's one of the names that they use for one of their groups. And this was this group whose main aim is like organizing the kind of books and chanting ceremonies and things like that. So they don't actually develop like physical places like monasteries and things. There's other branches that do that. But the head of that, the executive director, is Wangmo, Tathang Tulku's daughter.
So are you going to use that piece of land and center?
If we can, yeah. So it's a matter of you know, talking to people, and because the administration's completely changed, and the new administration, they say, is very good, but the main problem is you know, and another thing that was very nice was these Hindus who were very, very supportive of Buddhism, like on a very, very sincere heart level, like Santoshananda said, he goes to the Bodhi tree, sits under there, just tears come out of his eyes every time, you know. And he told a very, very lovely story when he visits his guru, who's like 104 years old or something, and can't travel anymore, and he goes and visits his guru, and his guru says, where have you been, or where have you come from? He says, I come from Bodh Gaya. And the guru says, oh, Bodh Gaya, my heart, my heart. So these people obviously feel this very, very, very deep connection, you know, spiritual connection, so it's not that kind of slightly or extremely political animosity between the Hindus and Buddhists, which has, you know, happened a lot of times before. So it's just a matter of getting some plans, you know. It's like any of these things, if you kind of put in a professional and well-designed proposal, then people will take that seriously. And as you know, in India, the costs are not great. I mean, we estimated between $100,000 and $200,000 to set up a training center. You know, and that would be like accommodation for 40 nuns or something like that. So it's not at all undoable financially. Well, yeah, by getting her into this thing, she was thinking, oh, what are the nuns in Chittas going to say? And I suggested that she coordinate with the sisters in England because they like to come to India. You know, that's one of the few overseas places they actually can go to and travel around and so on, but of course they don't have a nunnery there. And I said it would be very nice if they were coming to India, then they could stay at the Bhikkhuni Training Center and give some teachings and stuff there, because they're one of the few, you know, Theravada nuns communities who's got good training and good education. So I asked if she could do that when she goes back to Amravati, or goes back to Chiswick. Oh, good. Yeah, she's liking it. She loves Bodh Gaya, and staying on there. Did you meet her in? Yeah. Very, very sweet. Yeah, very, very gentle heart. And she's enjoying it. No, she told me the story. She came with an attendant or something, who after a day decided they had to go back or something like that. I can't remember the exact story, but she's alone. She seems to be coping quite well. When I was there was this young British couple who actually sort of close supporters of Chithurst, Simon and Nadine, kind of 30-ish doctors. So they're all doctors. Warido was there as well, he's a doctor. Sister Titamed is a doctor. Nadine and they're all doctors. I was sick and they're all doctors. Yeah. And she's going to Russia in a couple of months to translate for Lumpur Sumedha in retreat. There's also a lovely group of Russian devotees there, so she was translating my talks into Russian. Among other interesting snippets I left out of that was one of the things Dhammasami told us, they've now started the Oxford Centre for Mindfulness Studies. Quite interesting, isn't it? Or Oxford Centre for Mindfulness or something like that. I think Oxford Centre for Mindfulness.
Thank you.